Welcome to CHOATE's Life Sciences Insights, a podcast series hosted by our intellectual property, litigation, and corporate attorneys, covering trending topics at the intersection of science and law.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this debrief session following the Supreme Court's highly awaited decision in Amgen v. Sanofi. I'm Peter Flynn, and I'm a principal in the Patent and IP Group at CHOATE, where I focus on patent portfolio development across various engineering disciplines with a focus on biomedical engineering, medical devices, and drug manufacturing. I'm joined today by Stephanie Schoenwald, a partner in the Patent and IP Group, and Sophie Wong, a partner in the IP Litigation Group. Steph and Sophie lead CHOATE's PTAB practice and have a wide range of experience in advising life science clients regarding obtaining, defending, and enforcing antibody patents in particular. Sophie also submitted an amicus brief on behalf of Sir Gregory Paul Winter and other interested scientists to the Supreme Court in the Amgen v. Sanofi case. Let's kick things off with some brief background about this case. This case arose out of a dispute between Amgen and Sanofi and Regeneron concerning the parties' competing antibody drugs for reducing cholesterol. Amgen sued Sanofi and Regeneron, asserting patents that purported to cover all antibodies that bind to a particular so-called sweet spot on a naturally occurring protein called PCSK9, which then block PCSK9 from impairing the body's mechanism for removing cholesterol from the bloodstream. After a jury trial, the district court found in favor of Sanofi and Regeneron and determined that Amgen's patents were invalid for lack of enablement. The Federal Circuit affirmed that decision. Amgen then petitioned the Supreme Court for relief. On May 18, 2023, the Supreme Court issued its highly anticipated opinion and affirmed 9-0 the Federal Circuit's decision. Justice Gorsuch authored the opinion. Now, many commentators to date have noted that the opinion in many ways simply endorses what the law of enablement is in the United States, which is that the specification must enable the full scope of the invention as defined by its claims. Justice Gorsuch spends much of the opinion discussing the court's prior enablement cases from decades, if not over a century ago, including cases concerning Samuel Morse's telegraph and Thomas Edison's incandescent light bulb. Indeed, Justice Gorsuch restated the largely uncontroversial position that the more one claims, the more one must enable. Given all of this focus on old case law and the unanimous affirmance of the Federal Circuit's decision, Sophie, in your view, is there really anything new coming out of this opinion?
Thanks, Peter. I heard a lot of people asking that question when the decision first came out. And I think the short answer is maybe not, but that's kind of the point. And frankly, it may also be the wrong question to ask. A number of people may not realize that while the Federal Circuit has written scores of opinions concerning enablement over the years, it's been nearly a century since the Supreme Court last addressed the issue squarely. And as Justice Gorsuch points out, the language of Section 112 of the Patent Act, which sets forth the enablement requirement, has remained largely the same since its inception in 1790. So the question before the court this time around, and I think a large part of why they even took up cert in the first place, was really whether the legal standard had changed, or maybe more to the point, whether the Federal Circuit had taken the law of enablement too far from its statutory origins. But given that Amgen conceded at the oral argument that it in fact agreed with the legal test set forth by the Federal Circuit, there wasn't much left for the Supreme Court to do. There was actually a joke made during the argument that given Amgen's concession, the court could dig the case, that is, dismiss it as improvidently granted, which is basically a formal way for the court to get rid of a case it granted cert on without addressing the merits. And while the court did not actually do that, as a practitioner, I can't help but be somewhat relieved that the court chose to issue a fairly straightforward opinion that simply reinforces the well-established principle that, like Justice Gorsuch wrote, if an inventor claims a lot but enables only a little, the public does not receive the benefit of the bargain.
Thanks, Sophie. So in a sense, the ruling is not surprising, but is there anything that you wish the court had done in the opinion that would have made things a little more interesting?
I think the one area where the court could have provided some more clarity is with respect to what factors courts should consider in deciding if the full scope of an invention is enabled. It was a bit jarring to me that the opinion did not even cite at all the N. Ray Wands case from the Federal Circuit, which has been the guiding light for patent practitioners for the last 35 years or so. While none of the eight factors in Wands are mandatory or dispositive, the Wands framework to decide if undue experimentation is required is what the Federal Circuit, district courts, and the PTAB have relied upon for decades to adjudicate enablement. So it's a bit striking that the Supreme Court did not even mention it, say, in a footnote. Instead, the court sort of indirectly endorsed the undue experimentation framework and some of the Wands factors. For example, the court noted that the specification may call for a reasonable degree of experimentation, which depends on the nature of the invention and the underlying art, and that hits Wands factors 2 and 8. The court also emphasized the breadth of the claims at issue, which is Wands factor 1, as well as the amount of direction the specification provided, which is Wands factor 6. And the court noted that a patent that merely forces those of skill in the art to engage in painstaking experimentation to see what works or not is not enablement, but merely a hunting license. And that sounds very similar to the undue experimentation standard that's been articulated by the Federal Circuit. Finally, the court agreed with Amgen that enablement is not measured against the cumulative time and effort it takes to make every embodiment within a claim. So while, again, the opinion does not really say anything wildly different from the law of enablement that we have all been applying before, it would have been nice for avoidance of doubt to get a slightly more explicit endorsement from the Supreme Court of the Federal Circuit's Wands factors and the undue experimentation test. And I'll be curious to see how the Federal Circuit, district courts, and the PTAB viewed this decision as we go forward.
Thanks, Sophie. Steph, what do you think? In your mind, does the court's opinion change much for patent prosecutors going forward?
I agree with Sophie that the court's decision pretty much reinforces what we already knew to be the case. Broad functional claims are going to be problematic. And as both of you previously mentioned, the Federal Circuit has taken this position for a while. So we've been living under this regime for quite some time on the patent prosecution side. Now, as we back up in time, we can take a look at how we got here, right? So historically, antibodies were claimed using functional features. A lot of times they were claimed focusing in on what the antibody was binding to, you know, for example, a particular antigen. This type of claim structure didn't really require any antibody structure per se to be included in the claims, but instead focused more on antigen identification and antigen structure as being the limiting features within the claim. Over time, the court started taking a look at this broad scope and pulled back from this approach. They started pulling back in other areas. So antibodies were not really the first targets. We started seeing the courts tailor in around DNA, for example, first. But ultimately, we see the courts responding to the breadth of the claims and that patent owners were getting for antibodies and starting to tailor those in. Right now, most antibody claims are required to recite the sequences for the complementarity determining regions, which are the portions of an antibody that bind to the antigen in order for the claims to become allowed. This scope is not entirely satisfactory for most patent owners because reciting sequences can be quite limiting. So the bar continues to seek out creative ways to claim antibodies. One approach we see is to sort of meet towards the middle, claim some functional features combined with some key structural features, but hopefully not going all the way to the specific sequences of the antibody. These types of approaches, and whether the office, courts, and other forums are going to allow those approaches is still to be seen. But we can expect the bar is going to continue to push on the boundaries of claim scope and try to obtain more than just sequences for their clients.
Thanks. So is it fair to say that genus claims are pretty much dead post-Amgen?
It's hard to say that genus claims generally are dead. Super broad, purely functional genus claims were already dead before this case. Again, as mentioned, we knew the Federal Circuit was not a fan of super broad functional genus claims. The caveat we all should keep in mind, however, is that genus claims have been granted. They continue to grant, and they may continue to grant in the future. But the key thing here is if you get those claims, they're going to likely be hard to enforce. So that is one thing that everyone should keep in mind, right? Even if we can get some of these claims to the office, it may not be something that you can necessarily assert against a third party. However, structural genera supported by data shouldn't be written off as easily. And we may see applications including more data, more description of features, et cetera, in order to obtain that type of claim. So with that in mind, and that sort of lead in, what can we do to, you know, help move cases forward? And one thing you can do is to describe as many embodiments as you can that fall within the scope of the claims. There are a number of ways to do this within a patent application. We see it more commonly from our European friends who include a lot of description in their summary of the different embodiments. Can also include them in numbered embodiments at the end. We should also try to be looking for data showing the desired functional requirements that are being included in the claim limitations and include that type of data in the application. Patent applicants should also consider including diverse embodiments that are within the scope of claims. So not enough just to list a lot of different embodiments that fall within the scope of the claim, but try to really highlight the diversity of the different embodiments that do fall within the scope. And that should help to provide some support across the breadth of broader claims. It's key in those instances to describe both the similarities of different embodiments and the differences. So in one sense, you want to provide guidance as to any common motifs, sequences, or other structural information that may be common to the various embodiments. That way you can start to hopefully link in and tie together some of the structure and the function that may be important for a claimed invention. But it's also important to address the differences, either by saying you can test the differences in to determine the various functions, or that one of ordinary skill in the art would have expected the differences to lead to a similar functional result. So yes, absolutely address the similarities, but keep in mind to address the differences as well. And then the specification should also include a detailed guidance that is sufficient to show that the full scope of the claims would work in a predictable manner. And you can do that, again, via a number of techniques. One is to have a tailored use of prophetic examples. So if you know that there are other variants that are being tested and your technical team is telling you that they expect those embodiments to work for a variety of reasons, it would be good to describe those reasons, but also provide prophetic examples showing how they would go about completing that testing. One note of caution I wanted to provide is earlier I mentioned that, you know, you may want to provide what was known to someone who's skilled in the art, but be careful with how much you want use the phrase known in the art, or, you know, a person of ordinary skill in the art would be aware of that type of phraseology within the specification, because while we're today talking about enablement and being careful about providing the right support for enablement, you should also keep in mind that there are other challenges that patent claims may face, including obviousness, and in which case having phrases like known in the art may actually cut against you. What about you, Peter? How do you see Amgen v. Sanofi playing out on the engineering side?
Thanks, Steph. So there are some differences in how enablement issues tend to surface on the engineering side, but I think it's similar to what you've described overall. So for starters, the sheer number of species that you're typically going to see on the engineering side is much lower than the millions plus that you might see or might be possible with antibodies or biology, composition claims, chemistry type claims, that type of thing. But it is possible to have large numbers of species on the engineering side, especially if you have complex systems with several features and a number of different possibilities for each feature. You could definitely see the number of combinations adding up. I think another thing is you're also more likely to be in the realm of the predictable arts and engineering compared to the life sciences, but that's not always going to be the case. You can have complex systems and or types of arts on the engineering side that are inherently unpredictable: fluid dynamics, combustor dynamics, thermodynamics, heat transfer characteristics, that type of thing. So you can also have unpredictable arts on the engineering side, but generally they're going to be more predictable. And then in summary, apples to apples, the analysis basically plays out the same way. If you have an engineering type invention with a large number of species where you're dealing with unpredictable arts, and especially if you're dealing with functional claiming, we would expect enablement and written description to play out the same way they do on the life sciences side. You're not going to be able to successfully claim and defend a large number of species that are incongruent with what you've enabled.
Peter, I liked your point about the predictable versus unpredictable arts, and I wanted to jump in just with one other comment, which is, while the bio space as a whole is typically thought of as being an unpredictable art, similar to, you know, chemistry in many ways, as the field grows and matures, it's worth, you know, assessing what a challenger is saying is unpredictable, because what was unknown and perhaps unpredictable 10 years ago is no longer, you know, is something that a person of ordinary skill in the art in the present may be able to actually achieve and to understand they could achieve with reasonable expectation. But returning to the engineering patent claims, I wanted just to see if you had any words of wisdom for how to strengthen claims in the engineering space following the Amgen decision.
I mean, I think, as you said previously, a lot of the things are things that we would already be doing. For example, to the extent possible, focusing on structural claiming rather than functional claiming. And this includes configured to type language, which is often ends up being convenient in the moment when you're trying to claim something, but it has widely understood drawbacks as well. And also to your point about spending time disclosing important embodiments, I think you'd want to spend time describing specific features in detail, which will help towards making those types of features more likely to be enabled. If you are writing genus claims, have a reasonable expectation about what you're going to be able to get allowed and also subsequently defend. Consider hybrid approaches, such as having backup positions as well as varying levels of broadness, which you could do either via additional claim sets within a single application or follow-on applications. So, Sophie, from a litigation perspective, does any of this give you heartburn?
No, I think you've hit all the key points. And these tips are really important to our clients in making sure they get sufficient patent protection coverage for their inventions for all sorts of purposes. As you know, most patents will never be litigated. That being said, the fact is, at the end of the day, we're going to see more enablement challenges coming up in patent disputes, particularly where you've got any semblance of a broad functional claim left. So the more you can be mindful of that and try to mitigate that through prosecution, the better. I also think it's really important to make sure that if you are litigating a case, to really dive into what exactly the level of skill is in the art and how complicated the technology at hand is. I found it interesting that the Supreme Court noted that the law of enablement applies equally to whether the case involves telegraphs devised in the 19th century, glues invented in the 20th, or antibody treatments developed in the 21st. I don't disagree that the legal standard is the same. That is, did you enable the full scope of the invention without undue experimentation? But unspoken within the court's opinion was definitely its agreement with Sanofi and Regeneron and with Sir Gregory Winter's amicus brief that, at least with respect to antibody science, the technology is sufficiently complicated that what Amgen's patents disclosed was just not enough. And I think that was evidenced by the justices' questions during the oral argument, which, unlike the court's opinion, were unusually focused on the technical details of the underlying invention. And I think that may also be in part why Justice Gorsuch's opinion quoted from the Winter brief in describing the background of the antibody science. So being able to explain clearly to a judge exactly why the experimentation is undue or not so undue in the particular field at hand will be critical. And this may suggest an even greater focus on the quality of the experts that you're engaging for a particular matter, but I think it's also instructive for the lawyers on either side in terms of drafting briefs and how to prepare for oral argument.
That's a good point, and one that gets missed by many practitioners, particularly practitioners who themselves have highly technical backgrounds and expertise. It also suggests that while we may be able to get broader claims through the patent office because we're able to convince examiners that the specification is sufficient, that may not be enough for a court later on or an agency such as the ITC or the PTAB. And so patent owners need to continually look at this issue and have they got enough, you know, support and data to back up the breadth of the claims that they're pursuing.
Exactly, which is why your point and Peter's point about utilizing hybrid approaches and all these backup positions is really important and can't be understated. You don't want to get excited about broad claims that you managed to squeak through the patent office and then bet your company on them, only to wish later that you had stuck in at least the one narrower claim that might actually survive litigation.
Thanks, Steph and Sophie. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been a closely watched case. It'll be interesting to see how enablement continues to evolve as technology evolves. We'll continue to keep an eye on it.
For more information, please visit www.choate.com. You can also listen to additional podcast episodes in the newsroom of our website and subscribe to them wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.